Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Even in this province where oil drives the economy, there's a few things we can still learn about this black gold. Dr. David Selby is trying something new, and that's a test to age when oil deposits were formed. And having pioneered in the field of microfluidics, Dr. Jed Harrison is now looking for ways to interface his microtechnologies with new ones at the even smaller nanoscale. And PhD candidate Justine Taylor is one of a new breed of scientists moving into the nano field. And Nicole McMullen heads up a new venture in Alberta's Peace Country to help northern inventors. These are the stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. You'd think that in Alberta we'd know everything there is to know about oil and then some. Well, apparently not. David Selby is a transplanted Brit and postdoctoral candidate in Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Alberta. And with the help of some funding from the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, he's working on a way to determine the age of oil deposits and the migration of that oil through the rocks.
The problem is the ability to actually work out an age of a geological material using an isotopic technique called radiometric dating. And the ability to actually date that material can then be applied to geological problems like working out the actual timing of migration of oil, because oil starts off in one rock, then it's squeezed out and it moves through other rocks, and then it basically ponds in what we call a reservoir. And along that movement you get material called bitumen left behind, and the idea is to try and actually date the material to get the idea of the timing of when that migration of oil occurred.
So the work that you're doing then is new? No one has done this before?
No, it's never been done before. I mean, there's an old study where people have actually looked at oil, but there's been nothing really since that, and it was just a very, very small study. So this is all very brand new.
How are you approaching it?
Approaching it from just basically collecting samples and then doing investigations by taking that and working out if we actually have those elements we're interested in the material. And then once we know that, then we're going ahead and doing a full analysis and then going from there. So we started off in an area where we got a very good idea of how old the material is, and then we do our analysis, and if we're going to get, the idea is to get the age of the material that we know, and if we get that, then we have a good understanding of what we're doing. So
what are some of the obstacles or the challenges that you have to overcome?
Challenges are, well, we don't know if the material has these elements to start with. We don't know how the isotope system has behaved since the material's formed. Yeah, they're the main ones. And then, obviously, because we're dealing with very, very small amounts of this material, it's actually getting, you know, accurate and precise data. So that's another obstacle as well. And then there's also analytical problems as well, because we have to make sure that we're actually doing the analysis properly. We're not inducing any human problems rather than just geological. We don't want to complicate matters.
You're using some fairly sophisticated equipment. One of the labs is a clean lab, and in this one I noticed on the door as you come in you have to take a shower and be very careful about things. What are some of the things you're using?
One of the most dangerous things we're using, well, not dangerous, just to be careful, is carbon tetrachloride. Years ago it used to be used in dry cleaning because it's basically a very good solvent for getting material off clothes and things like that, but it's carcinogen. It's known to be a cancer causer, so obviously we wear gloves and lab coat and goggles, and we always go in a fume hood, so it's just something that we're cautious about. But you know, and we'll use a lot of acid as well, but again we're just cautious using gloves and wearing, you know, eye protection, things like that. So
we're in one of your labs right now. What do you want to show me?
Well, something I can show you is how we actually dissolve our samples. This is basically a glass tube that we called a Karas tube, and we put our sample in, which basically looks like this black substance here, which is called bitumen. We place it in here with an acid that's going to dissolve it, because the elements we're interested in are actually sort of held within the material. So the idea is to liberate those into solution, and we do that by adding the acid. We seal the tube, and then we place it in an oven and basically let it heat for a couple of days at a very high temperature. And this is what it looks like. It just goes into a solution, and then after that we actually extract out the elements to actually have basically two separate vials of the elements that we're interested in. So,
what would be those elements?
The elements are called rhenium and osmium. And we're interested in those because the element of rhenium decays to osmium, and that's our radiometric system, and we use that for dating.
You've also got a rock here. What's this?
The rock is actually how the material looks in nature. And basically, this is it's from what's known as a Mississippi Valley-type deposit that has lots of lead and zinc in it. So that's the economic importance behind this rock anyway. But also at the same time that the lead and the zinc are forming, we have this material which is black here, which is called bitumen, and that's came in or believed to have come into the system at the same time carried by fluids that have carried the actual lead and the zinc. So then we just basically take out that bitumen and separate it, and then it's the bitumen that we're actually analysing. So that is the rock anyway.
What have you found out so far?
We found out the bitumen does have rhenium and osmium in it. From preliminary study of one area, we're actually able to get a geological age from the bitumen. And there's a few other things that we're not too sure about, but we have a very small understanding of this material. And there is further greater importance of what we can use this material for like understanding when the timing of migration of oil, which is going to be very important.
Have you made any headway there? Like, do you know what the timing is?
We know the timing in one instance, but for other areas we don't know yet. It's just something we're going to try and work out.
What's new then in terms of the migration of the oil?
In this case, it's just telling us that the migration of oil has occurred at the same time as the lead and the zinc formation has occurred in these rocks. So,
what would account for that?
What do you mean by what would account for it?
Well, if they formed at the same time, what does that mean?
It just means geologically the oil and the fluids carrying the lead and zinc have actually occurred at the same time, which is what we see geologically in that deposit.
Is that different from current thinking?
Not necessarily, but in some cases there is known to be multiple events of like oil coming through these systems. But this was a starting point to see if we could actually get an age for bitumen and then take it into areas that we don't have a good understanding of the actual timing of oil at all.
How is it then that the oil actually forms in the first place?
Well, the oil forms from a rock unit called a black shell, which is just full of organic material and then has lots of carbon in that organic material, and essentially through time oil is actually formed within that rock unit. So it's actually small globules of oil actually held within the oil, and then what happens through time is that rock is basically it's forced out of it. It's like a big sponge is actually squeezed out of it, and then that oil actually migrates through rocks until it's trapped somewhere. So that's really, in short terms, how it's formed.
This is your first stab at trying to get an answer on these questions, but are there some discrepancies that you have to deal with in terms of the age of the oil that you find in one place as opposed to another?
One of the problems is with actually oil is that in a reservoir itself, it may not just be one source. It may come from multiple sources, so you may be dealing with oils of very different ages. So that's one of the problems, and that's why we decided to look at bitumen as itself, because from what we understand now is that we can get an age from bitumen, but it may be coming from rock units that are far and away older, so that tells us something about how the isotope systems are behaving.
What would be the application or the significance of knowing that?
Understanding exactly when the oil is actually migrating, how it may actually migrate through different areas, for example, through the Canadian Rockies. And also just for understanding how the geological process has actually worked. One of the ideas is actually to understand reservoir filling in oil systems, so that's one application.
And would that also help oil exploration if you wanted to go look in different areas?
It may help in oil exploration, but the idea is to give the oil companies a grasp on understanding the actual system in better manners, so to actually understand when the reservoirs have actually filled through time, which is something quite difficult to do.
What's the next step for you?
The next step is to go to other areas and look at bitumen from other areas to make sure that the system is behaving in the same way before we start making large conclusions from just one area. So that's the next step, really. Take very small steps to understand one material in a much better way.
What do you like about this? What excites you?
It's a challenge because it's unknown. There is a question, but the answer is not known yet. So that's the fun of it anyway, doing something completely different that no one's ever done before.
Well, I wish you luck. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. David Selby, a postdoctoral candidate in Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Alberta. His research on aging oil is supported by the Alberta Ingenuity Fund. Nanotechnology is a new field of science that's broadening our horizons in ways that most people simply cannot comprehend. Even scientists working in the nano field are finding they have a whole new set of unknowns to deal with. That's one of the lessons I learned in talking with Dr. Jed Harrison. Jed is a professor of chemistry at the University of Alberta, a pioneer in what's called microfluidics. And he's one of the first researchers hired by the new National Institute for Nanotechnology to help secure Canada's future on the nano stage.
We've been working for a number of years on using microfabrication techniques to miniaturize chemical instrumentation and to make what people have been calling a lab on a chip. And so the idea is that you can take the same kind of chemistry you would do in beakers and in large instruments, and take a glass or a silicon chip and make micro-sized channels into it, something smaller than the size of a human hair, and flow all the liquids through those with electric fields and direct them together, run chemical, biochemical reactions, and perform analyses. We can do that with chemicals and with cells and with DNA and biochemicals. And so it gives us a way of miniaturizing what you do in the laboratory down to a very small scale. And it has a lot of advantages. It means you use less sample, it means you make less waste, you use fewer chemicals. And things, because they're on such a small scale, are typically much faster. And if it's faster and it uses less, it should be cheaper.
So then if you're working with microfluidics on the micro scale, does nano just make it even smaller?
Well, the nanoscale is another three orders of magnitude smaller, in essence, than the microscale. And so there is a noticeable difference. And in fact, it was a deliberate part of our effort. We deliberately stayed in sizes above a micron because the physics doesn't change in that range. And so we could work on how to shrink things and know that it was the task of shrinking it that was the challenge and not a new challenge arising because the physics changed. So when one goes below a micron scale, somewhere actually around, say, 100 nanometers and smaller, the physics begins to change. And that means you'll see phenomena that you don't expect. And some of that will just be a problem. And some of that could lead to great big advantages. And that's, of course, what makes nanotechnology an interesting field, because in that sort of 10 nanometer to 100 nanometer size range, the physics is different. And you have to include factors that you normally don't have to include. And so that gives you unique properties. In fluidic systems, we expect that there will be a difference as we go below 100 nanometers. And there are experiments people have done that have shown that. And so there should be new phenomena that we can take advantage of to create different kinds of analysis or different kinds of chemistry and different kinds of systems. But the sort of entree we see as moving from microfluidics into the nanofluidics area is that there's a huge interface problem in nanotechnology. You get all of these things you can make that are incredibly small, but there's no tools, there's no fingers that allow people to reach down into that size range and actually control it and make it do the things they want or harvest from it the results from working in the nanoscale. So microsystems can provide the fingers, if you will, that reach down into that dimension. And we picture making microfluidic devices that taper down into nanometer scales and use that as a way of controlling things that are made in a nanometer size range.
What are some of the things that you've experienced then with this new physics that has to be discovered and dealt with?
Well, molecules don't behave in the same way as they do in a large solution. As they're trying to move through a very small channel, the actual size and shape of the molecule begins to have a big effect on how it will move through the fluid in that very small channel. That means that some things don't go where you want them to go, and that could be a problem. But you can also use that to advantage. You can use it to make certain molecules move away and trap others in a particular location, and it's a kind of filter, if you will. So that'd be one key example.
I've heard you speak now at a couple of conferences about molecular motors. In a nutshell, what are those?
Nature uses molecules in biological cells as motors. So you obviously the muscle must be a motor, or else it couldn't move. So what nature's done is find a variety of molecules that will change shape in organized ways to accomplish a goal. And we think of those as motors. So muscles are an example of a linear motor, where the muscle will expand and contract in a line and give you a force and motion. Another example is the molecular assembly that exists in all of our cells that allows us to convert glucose into energy, or another molecule that the body can use as energy. And that's a motor that spins, rotates a central protein molecule, rotates on its axis around a core of other molecules, and as it rotates, it drives a chemical reaction. So that's a molecular motor. We've imagined that microfluidic systems and nanofluidic interfaces within them could be used to actually direct the flow of molecules onto individual molecular motors, or in perhaps an even more ambitious concept that we could use nanofluidic structures to organize where molecular motors grow or are placed, so you can make a organized set of city streets, if you will, with a bunch of motors on them in particular patterns.
Where do you see all of this heading?
No idea. This kind of nanotechnology is very blue sky at this point. It's hard to know exactly where it will go. One could imagine you'll get materials that are very adaptive, that can change their properties in ways we want them to as the conditions around them change. But it's easier to see where the other kinds of nanotechnology are going than it is to see where these modified biomaterials concepts are going to go.
Can you give me some examples?
One example is in dyes or pigments. There's something called quantum dots, which are very small, 10 nanometer sized particles of semiconductors or metals. And these change their colors substantially as you change the size over very small size change ranges. Those are pigments, essentially, and they already have commercial applications. So it's easy to see if you make those, and you can make a whole sequence of colors very easily, that you have a commercial product. There may be much more fundamentally exciting applications of those materials in the future, but there's an obvious one that's apparent today and where the technology can come into play today. Where these molecular motors and nanofluidics could play a role, I think, is going to be judged 10 to 15 years in the future. In contrast, the microfluidics we've been doing in the past 10 years, we could identify a role for it after about 5 years of research, and there are now commercial products available. This is a longer time frame.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Jed Harrison, a professor of chemistry at the University of Alberta and a researcher with the National Institute for Nanotechnology. While visiting one of Jed's labs, he introduced me to a young PhD candidate in his group, Justine Taylor. Sitting in front of her computer, her head topped with bright pink hair, Justine exemplifies the new wave of researchers attracted to the nano field. In fact, Justine is the first recipient of the National Research Council's Nanotechnology Prize.
It was a prize that was initiated last year between the University of Alberta and the National Research Council, and it was kind of in celebration of the founding of the NINT, which is the National Institute for Nanotechnology, which is here on campus. And yeah, so they had a prize within the University of Alberta, and that's about it.
What did you do in order to get the prize?
Actually, I didn't have to do anything. It was actually a supervisor responsibility. So Jed sent in an application for me, as well as some of the other members in our group. And that's all. Then they decided it.
What is it that got you interested in the nanotechnology side of things?
I guess it's a little bit the aspect of science fiction to it, that it's really fun science to do, and it is really cool. And it's an emerging field, which is always exciting, because there's lots of room to grow and expand and lots of new ideas and kind of groundbreaking stuff that's going on. So it's pretty interesting.
With your PhD work that you're doing under Dr. Jed Harrison, what are you looking at?
What we do, or what I do specifically, is that I have I've designed a system in order to study protein interactions. So there's a field called proteomics, which is a very big field right now. And so what we're looking at is ways to increase the throughput of proteomics procedures, because right now, at least, the procedures in order to identify proteins are very time-consuming. So we're taking our microchips and trying to find a way to speed up those procedures. So I guess the way that it reflects, or the way it contributes to the field of nanotechnology, is that protein-protein interactions are very important for the field of nanotechnology, because a lot of people are looking at building, you could think of them as almost little tiny machines, by sticking different proteins together. So you have to know how they interact in order to be able to, you know, stick the right ones together.
Where do you hope to go with this?
This project, basically what this project was about was designing a system. And so we've designed the first system, and now we're, you know, kind of seeing where the flaws in that system are, and we're going to, you know, make a better system and stuff like that. And I don't know if it'll go too much further than that.
Once you have this PhD under your belt, what's the future for you?
Well, I just found out actually last night that I got funding from NSERC for a postdoctoral fellowship. So I'd like to move slightly away from the field of microfluidics and more into the nanotechnology side of things. And what exactly I'm doing, I'm not quite sure yet, but I'll have to make up my mind soon.
Well, congratulations. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Justine Taylor, a PhD candidate in chemistry at the University of Alberta. Her supervisor is Dr. Jed Harrison, one of the first scientists retained by the new National Institute for Nanotechnology. I recently attended an inventor's workshop sponsored by the Capital Region Innovation Center. And there, I met Nicole McMullen. Nicole had traveled all the way from Grand Prairie to Edmonton to get some tips and make some new contacts. Back home, she's the project manager for a new venture in the Peace Country. It's called the Innovation Network.
The Innovation Network is a result of the Peace Region Economic Development Alliance, which is a membership of 41 municipalities and organizations and industry, doing some research and identifying a gap in the Peace Country. And what that gap was is that there were not services to inventors who were trying to get their idea to market.
Are there a lot of people up there who are inventing?
We just recently actually were given a quote from a gentleman who works with IRAP, and he said that the highest number of inventors in all of Canada comes out of the Peace Country.
Now, why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's our vigor, northern vigor, and our environment, what we face day in and day out. I'm not sure.
Well, it could be too, you know, if you're in an isolated communities and you've got to make do, you're always coming up with better ideas.
Yes, perhaps that is the reason. I know that another area that we are proud of in the Peace Country, and it has something to do with innovation certainly, is that some of our agri-food products are so far, for the most part, anecdotally, suggested to be of higher nutritional value. Our seed potatoes actually have been proven through research to have higher nutritional value due to our long daylight hours. And so that's something where perhaps that is spurring some of our residents to become inventive, innovative around our products as well.
So people who are in northern Alberta, what can you offer them?
Our services range from no-fee services to some fee-for-service services. They include helping folks with technical problem-solving predominantly. We do have a partnership with our Community Futures in the region. Community Futures Development Corporations offer business startups, business planning, some equity if they need it. So we work with our partners in the region for that end. But more on the technical problem-solving side, we give assistance in terms of if folks are interested in our investment capital program. We've partnered with a few folks to put together some dollars in terms of venture capital or angel investments. We do provide some matchmaking services with mentors in the region, and we also provide a workshop now to help build a culture of innovation in the Peace Country. So the Innovation Network is focusing, as I mentioned, a few of our client services, and as well on capacity building of the region. So building a culture of innovation within our area for companies as well as individuals.
How do people get in touch with you?
The Innovation Network has our main office in Fairview, and we do have a website that's just been launched. It's www.peacecountrycanada.com, and we're on the website there, and our contact information can be found there. That's probably the easiest.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to meet you.
That was Nicole McMullen, Project Manager for the Peace Country Innovation Network. Brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during the program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, the Capital Region Innovation Center, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the Alberta Conservation Association, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, the University of Lethbridge, True North Energy, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.